Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is Tuesday the 2nd. It's our first gathering as a committee for the special session in this mini session of February. What we're going to do today is multiple things. First, we need to do our organizational meeting, and that's the introductions. We then are going to start with informational meeting on two bills that have been noticed for information meeting. We are not able to actually hear the specific bills and will not have the summaries for the staffs on each of the bills until 9:30. What the plan of the chair is to do is to take as much invited testimony, which is any of those individuals who may be here today. As we move through this process, we will try to divide the time as proportionally as we need to make certain we have, let's say, equal time as necessary for each of the two bills that we will be hearing at 9:30. And then at 9:30, we will then go into the regular mode of public hearing on each of the bills. I do want to make a few comments. As everyone realizes from our experience 2 years ago, this is an exponential time frame that we have to conduct our business, and that is why we're trying to cram as much as we can into as little amount of time as possible. These two bills will be carried over for work session on Thursday of this week. And at that time, if the chair and or if the committee wants to hear from additional individuals, we may invite individuals to come up at that time. But we're going to try to conclude our public hearing on each of these bills today. So with that, I guess what I'd like to do is start off with just a reminder, all of us that are sitting here on Judiciary for this interim special session, we're serving on the Judiciary Committee during the 09 session, but I think it is appropriate for us, for those who have not met us, to get an introduction. So I'm going to ask each of the members to kind of state your name and what district you're from, and we'll get through this process. And we'll start to my right.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I apologize. We were stuck in traffic. There was a lot of state police on the road, and so we were making sure to go with the flow, which is a good thing, to have more state police on the road. I'm State Senator Jackie Dingfelder, and this is my second year in the Oregon Senate. That's right. It's January. I've served for 9 years in combination of the House and Senate, and I represent Northeast Southeast Portland. I did serve on Judiciary in the House for a while, and very pleased to be on the Judiciary Committee and to be here, Mr. Chair, this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm State Senator Brian Boquist, District 12. I'm not a lawyer, so this is all confusing, and I represent the rural portions of Willamette County, Willamette Valley.
Do we have to declare whether an attorney or not?
No,
I'm not a lawyer either.
That's a good thing, too.
Like
to
say, like we say, but being on Judiciary is like going to law school without going into debt.
All right, and I'm State Senator Floyd Przanski. My district is District 4. It includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties, and I've been a member of the Senate since 2003 and previously served in the House for 6 years. Prior to that.
I'm State Senator Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in the northeast part of Washington County, and it also goes down into northwest Portland. I served in the House in 2007 and served on the House Judiciary Committee there, and I'm pleased to be on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I do have a law degree, but please do not hold that against me.
My name is Doug Whitsett. I represent Senate District 28. Which encompasses all or parts of five counties in southern and eastern Oregon. I was elected to the Senate in 2004, and I've been on Judiciary pretty much all the time. Thank you.
Bill?
Oh, excuse me. I thought maybe you were doing members and then staff. I'm Bill Taylor. I'm Council Judiciary Committee. I live in Salem, Oregon, and this is my 23rd year here.
I'm Anna Brahman of the other Council for Judiciary. I've been with the, I think this is my third legislative session, fourth legislative session. So, and I live in Salem, Oregon.
And then our capable staff that keeps the records and makes sure we are doing everything as we are required and making sure that's captured for prosperity and for future use is Courtney Johnson. Courtney, thank you very much for being here. She also worked with us last session, and it's great to have the full team back. So with that, as I mentioned, what we're going to do is we're going to open it up. I guess maybe we should look at who we have that's signed up.
Okay, we should do the introduction.
Okay, and so I'm going to go ahead and gavel in for organizational meeting, and at this point, the adoption of the committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the rules before us, and then I'll have comment.
All right, Senator Boquist moves for the adoption of the Senate rules, and this is the Senate Judiciary Committee rules for 2010 special session. And to your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, these are pretty much the standard set of rules that we see in a special session, if not the regular session. The one point in the future I would like to get clarification on is on point five, 1 hour notice. At what point, and I suspect we'll have to hear from the president, at what point does the 1 hour authorization for committee notice kick in versus the 24 hours? And I would just note that under five, it says give 24 hours notice, and then down later in subsection A, it says actually one of those subsections.
A,
right. Or 1 hour notice. So I guess for clarification for all of us, at what point does the emergency become the 1 hour emergency in the next 28 days? If we could find that out in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for putting that on the record. We will get clarification from either the President's office or from the Secretary of the Senate. At this point, we are working under the 24-hour rule, and that's how today's meeting was noticed. As you can see from the agenda, the public hearing, official public hearing, and possible work session is not scheduled until 9:30, which was 24 hours after the reading of the bills. Any other comments on the rules? Any objection to the adoption of the model rules that are before us? Not hearing any, they are adopted. All right, now at this point, we're going to go ahead and open up our informational hearing. We're starting to get the room to fill in a little bit, so for those who weren't here, what we're going to do is try to proportionately divide the time until 9:30. We have approximately 45, we have an hour and 15 minutes to take in informational hearings, and then we can move into our official position on the public hearings on each of the bills. So I think what we'll do at this point is we'll start with the first bill that's scheduled for at 9:30 on the informational hearing, and this is going to be dealing with what will is Section 17 of House Bill 3508 that was passed during the 2009 regular session, and that Section 17 is was dealing with the area of the earned time. And with that, let's go ahead and let's see. Trying to think of who. Yeah, why don't we start off? Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, if you'd like, I can give a little bit of background on this.
Why don't you do that,
sure.
And then I'll kind of, I see Craig is here, so we'll maybe bring Craig up to give us another, and Jan.
Chair, members of the committee, you may remember this bill from last session. It was before us in for quite a few meetings in one form, one bill, and then moved to another. And you mentioned Section 17 of the bill. What we did last session, currently and since at least 1989, inmates have been eligible for earned time up to 20%. With the adoption of Measure 11, certain crimes were excluded from earned time. What we did in earned time, if I remember correctly, of the inmates eligible for earned time, they earn about 60 to 65% of it, so it's not a gimme. And what we did last session as a result of budget constraints was build on earned time by adding an additional 10%. Prior to 1989, actually, when we had the parole board, inmates were eligible for a third earned time. That was rolled back in 89 to 20%. And what we did on the bill from last session is allow an additional 10%. The Constitution, the Victims' Rights initiatives that were adopted, referred to the legislature back, I'm trying to think, 1999, allowed victims to be heard at any proceeding, and it also required that any sentence that be modified had to be done in open court. So to apply the additional 10% to people that had already been sentenced you had to go back and have another hearing. That's required by the Constitution. And in the bill last session, we excluded certain crimes from the additional 10%. So these were people that were already found in open court by a judge to be eligible for 20%. We said that they could go back to court, and the judge could determine whether they should get an additional 10%. And the crimes that were excluded from that list, in addition to Measure 11, rape in the third degree, sodomy in the third degree, sexual abuse in the second degree, criminally negligent homicide, assault in the third degree, assault in the fourth degree, and then it says the crimes listed 137.700, which is Measure 11, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Oh, excuse me, and then H, an attempt to commit a crime describes through A through G. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's basic background on 3508. Section 17.
All right. I think at this point I'm going to ask Craig Prince and Jennifer Black. And Jennifer, is there someone else that you'd like to have instead from the Department of Correction? If y'all would come forward and maybe give us some additional perspective of how things have started to play out.
Max is here.
Oh, Max. I'm sorry.
Max.
I didn't see that.
Chair, I was tempted to send you after up. She
was going like this for a second. Get the guy next to me. Sorry for not having my glasses up high enough or low enough to actually see.
I understand, Mr. Chair. For the record, Max Williams, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections.
And for the record, Craig Prince from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission.
So basically, just kind of an overview from your perspectives as to what the goals were to accomplish and where we're at and how things have played out.
Mr. Chair, I can provide some factual information in response to this legislation and its implementation, and then with the assistance of Mr. Prince, would be happy to try to answer any questions that you have. The department at this stage, to give you some sort of numbers, there were approximately 4,000, I can find it right here, about 4,800 individuals who were incarcerated who were entitled to receive some eligibility processing with respect to the increased earn time. I think one of the challenges that people have had with respect to understanding how this law applied is a basic fundamental challenge regarding how sentencing often works in criminal cases. It's quite rare, actually, that an individual is simply sentenced for a single crime. In the vast majority of cases, people in our system are serving sentences for multiple crimes, sometimes actually committed in different counties with a different number of offenses, who have different parts of statutes with respect to sentencing apply. And so as a result, there were 4,800 individuals who had some portion of their sentence inside their time serving in the Department of Corrections that would qualify as being eligible under the statute for review and determination about whether they would actually receive additional earned time. The process resulted in letters of eligibility being sent to the offender, to the court, and to the district attorney's office who had prosecuted the individual on the eligible crime. And then from there, the district attorney's office is engaged in notifications of the victim. To the extent that there was an objection raised to the granting of the additional earn time, there was a process established between the Department of Corrections and the courts by which a hearing was scheduled. The hearings were conducted by to the best of my knowledge, they were all telephonic. I'm not aware of any of them that weren't, although it's possible there may have been one or two that I'm not aware of. But the hearings were conducted telephonically with the court, with the opportunity for victims to be present if they chose to, and then the court would issue a ruling. On those cases where no objection was raised, and the court had the authority to simply issue a new amended judgment granting the additional earn time, and those were processed by the department, and then the effect of the new judgment would affect the release date of the offender, and then that was processed through our process as to how that individual was released. To the extent that it meant that they would be released immediately. In some cases, it did result in immediate releases of some number of offenders who were close enough to their normal time of release that this upped that release date. To a larger number, it simply meant that their projected release date was shifted at some level and that they weren't released. The data that we have reflects that 3,473 of that 4,800 were approved. About 766 of them were denied. There were 43 cases in which there was a partial granting of the earned time. In other words, it might have been less than the full 30%, or it may have been on not all of the crimes. So some of them may have been granted on some of the eligible crimes and not on others of the eligible crimes. And there were 260 of that number who were actually released from prison because their release date was close enough prior to their earned time calculation being processed. In other words, they couldn't move through the process in a timely enough way that their normal release date came up and they got out on their normal release date. So they were technically eligible, but it didn't have any impact with respect to their sentence. Our data reflects that the average sentence length impact is about 55 days. So typically, particularly on the early releases where people were getting out ahead of their otherwise projected release date, it appears that they were getting out on average about 55 days ahead of what their other sentence would have required. With respect to the impact with costs, this was projected in the 09-11 biennium to save the Department of Corrections approximately $6 million. That was based essentially on a savings associated with not filling our temporary and emergency beds. So it used a lower per bed rate because we were anticipating that these bed savings would be essentially savings associated with our temporary and emergency beds. It's difficult at this stage to fully estimate the impact, my understanding is from folks in our budget office who are tracking this that we're relatively close to being projected on track. We're working with the Criminal Justice Commission, who really is doing the data collection and the analysis on the impact. But them working together suggests at this point that if it were to continue in its current form, we would come close to achieving. It would be a little less, in part, I think, because the denial rates are slightly higher than I think were originally anticipated. It would be relatively close to achieving the financial impact that the bill was intended to have. So that's a brief overview, Mr. Chair, and it may be just easier to respond to questions to the best we can if the committee has them.
Okay, Max, thank you. Craig, did you have anything else you want to add? I want to go ahead and open up for questions. We'll start Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max, can you give me, 260 actually released, average 55 days. What's the average incarceration cost in the state of Oregon per day?
Just rough average.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, I want to make sure that I make this point, that the 260 that I indicated were released were people who they didn't get the benefit of any additional earned time. Their release date came up during the time that they were being processed, so they just got out on their normal release date. So they sort of fall out of that 4,800 number because they didn't actually ultimately get any earned time reduction.
Additional.
Additional. In some cases, maybe not. I mean, it's hard to know on an individual case-by-case basis, but essentially, they got released before whatever process this was in, before a hearing could get scheduled, or before they got the notice back from the court. They were just bumping right up to that line. The challenge with any process like this is that you're dealing a lot with sort of averages. There are some people who are going to save, if they got their hearing process, they may have only gotten out 2 days early because by the time it all got done, that would have been their normal release date. And that happens, obviously, with those folks who are nearing their release date at the time this got implemented. But to answer your question, Senator, the per-day bed cost from a budgeted standpoint that we work with LFO on is around $80 per day.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So now you've corrected me. How many do we actually release as a result of the bill after you pull everything out of what's the headcount that actually got released?
that was impacted and got released because of this.
Yeah, it's been released to date. I want to say that number is, okay, here we go.
We needed you up here.
We just asked this question a moment ago.
No, she left too.
Yeah.
Leaving Ms. Sink.
So 952 inmates have released that were released at least one day early
due to
being resentenced to earn the 30%. And that's the problem in sort of calculating this, is some of them are going to get, you know, one day, and some of them are going to get 20 days, and some of them are going to get 60 days. It's just going to vary, obviously, based on what their sentence impact was and how this got processed. It's also important, I think, again, to remind the committee that when we calculated the savings on this, we were conservative in calculating the expense associated with the release of these offenders was really freeing up temporary and emergency beds in our system. So it was sort of the marginal cost associated with freeing up that individual bed, not the fully loaded $80-some dollars a day cost. Because what we were really doing is we're freeing up a bed that we're not having to use as a temporary and emergency bed. And a temporary and emergency bed in our system has a lower marginal cost than essentially a base bed in our population.
Well, Pushner, sure. In regard to that, and obviously just to give equal time to the opposite side, is even though it's daily cost or whatever, what do you think the cost impact, or how much did it come about to cost to go through this entire process? Because if you go through the entire process and the net $6 million, what did it cost us to save $6 million? In theory.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, you know, I've thought about this a couple of different ways. At the end of the day, I didn't get an additional dollar I got $6 million backed out of my budget as a result of this, and I didn't get an additional dollar. So for processing the way we process this, at the end of the day, I guess technically it didn't cost us any additional money. Because we, you know, obviously we had a bunch of people who is particularly that processing for those people who were going to get immediate release. There were a lot of people who did a lot of work and maybe had to set aside work that they were otherwise going to be doing for a period of time, particularly at our offender information and sentence computation unit up in Wilsonville, where all of these judgments had to be processed and all the sentences and the earned time data had to be calculated. Those people worked an incredibly hard effort at trying to move this material and information through the process in a careful way, trying to avoid mistakes and yet being timely and responsive to the courts and everything that they had to do. At the end of the day, other work may have gotten set aside for a period of a month or two while that process happened, but we didn't get any additional money. We didn't technically spend any additional money outside of our appropriated funds to get it done. We simply postponed other work that they would have been doing for a period of time and had a backlog in other areas that could have been postponed that ultimately had to get worked off.
Final question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's exactly my point, is that, you know, you took the finger out of the Dutch dike and stuck it in here and it's leaking over here. There's a cost associated with doing this, and I was just trying to get a grasp of what that cost would be, because that delayed work is now going to have to be done later.
And Chair Przanski and Senator Boquist, and I guess I maybe I've been now the director long enough that everything sort of is in a two-year budget cycle, and what I know is at the end of 2 years, I've got a certain amount of money and I can't spend more than the money that the legislature's appropriated me, so we'll do everything we're going to do within the budget. That $6 million was backed out of my budget in ways and means at the time that my budget got put forward. So essentially, yeah, you know, the savings has been the $6 million that got backed out of my budget, and at this stage I haven't had anybody offer to refund any of that's short of what was projected. I'm frankly not anticipating that I'm going to get that offer from anybody. So, you know, the savings is going to be what the savings got backed out of my budget is. It's going to be the $6 million that wasn't funded in my budget.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Whitson?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Williams, the original bill from last year apparently allowed eligibility to some felons that shouldn't have been eligible. And that's, as I understand, the primary purpose of the bill before us today is to fix that. And so the question is, have any felons been released from prison or have been allowed additional earned time that shouldn't have been according to that scenario I just laid out? I mean, did it, that are any of those that did get released or have earned time in the categories that would be prevented from eligibility in Senate Bill 1007?
Chair Prozanski and Senator Witt said it's possible that Mr. Prinz may have better information about that than I do. I think in a number of the crimes that have gotten the attention, obviously, of the committee, public, I'm not aware of, and got media attention, I'm not aware in any of those cases where the court actually granted the additional earned time. As I indicated, there's over 700 or some odd of these that have been reviewed by the court, where the court, 740 some, where the court has actually denied the request for additional earned time and they haven't received it. And I would guess that the vast majority probably fall in the kinds of crime categories that the committee is actually reviewing. But I'm not capable at this point of answering the question of whether or not in any of those crime categories someone actually got the additional earned time and was received any reduction in sentencing. In the kind of numbers we're talking about, it seems likely to me that there would be some where that would likely have occurred.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think the answer is no. I don't think there were any that were excluded from consideration by the bill, I think is your question, Senator. So the bill, House Bill 3508, Section 17, had crimes that were excluded from consideration. And I don't think anyone was mistakenly resentenced on something that was excluded. I think that Director Williams mentioned the issue of many offenders had multiple counts of crimes, but I'm not aware of a situation where I'm not aware of a situation where someone was mistakenly sentenced. I mean, I think that's the good thing about the Oregon Constitution. The way it works is these go to a hearing. The district attorney is notified. The district attorney notifies the victim, and they do have a hearing to make sure nothing like that would happen.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, maybe I misunderstood your question. I didn't understand your question to be asking whether or not we had inadvertently allowed someone earned time for an excluded crime.
You understood it correctly, Max.
Did I have it correctly?
Yes. Okay. I'm talking about if Senate Bill 1007 had been passed in 2009, I'm talking about the difference between the two there.
Right.
And your response was right on, yes.
Okay. Yeah. I wanted to make sure that I was responding accurately.
Right.
Okay.
And then,
yeah, you have another one?
Yes, I do. This, both the bill in 2009 and this bill before us today are very confusing to read, very confusing to understand which felons are eligible for hearings and which ones are not. In your opinion, if this bill were rewritten to be prospective rather than restrictive, being perspective meaning, okay, these 17 categories or these 27 categories are eligible as opposed to these are the ones that are not eligible, wouldn't that be a clear, easier method of writing a bill like this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I'm not sure from our purposes of implementation, bills are read by lots of people who have lots of different interests, and for some it may be easier to write it in the way that you've described. I think for our purposes, it doesn't matter much to us. I think we're capable, particularly our offender and sentence computation people who do the real work of figuring out who is and who isn't eligible, they're pretty good about being able to read a piece of legislation, plug into our system the crimes that meet eligibility or that are ineligible, regardless of how that plays out in the bill. They translate this into sort of a matrix that they use in the office to look at somebody's judgment, and if certain crimes are mentioned in the ORSs that are part of the judgment, they know whether to include them or not include them. So for our purposes, I don't know that it makes much difference. There are certainly plenty of other people who are going to be in contact with this legislation who may have a different opinion about how to get it structured and how to read it and how to write it in a way that's clearer, but we don't probably have much of
it. One short follow-up. Has there been any public confusion over who should be eligible, who was eligible, who actually did have hearings? I mean, as far as a result of the way the law was written, has there been any confusion from that standpoint on the part of the public?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitson, I think there has been confusion about this, and I think it goes back primarily to the issue that I raised at the beginning. I think most people assume that when somebody's convicted of a serious crime, they have the image of a guy getting a significant sentence, and it's one sentence, and it's for a set amount of time, and he sits in his cell, and he kind of makes those hash marks on the wall with the line through him like we've all seen in the movies, and he's counting his day until he gets released. And the reality is that's typically not the case in most of these sentences. In most of these sentences, there's an underlying crime that may be a serious crime, as we've learned, obviously, in some of these cases where people are eligible for the earned time, there's an underlying crime that's much more serious to where they weren't eligible in the underlying crime. It didn't qualify as a crime where they were eligible for the earned time, and they have served all of their sentence under that crime, and now they're serving the sentence for a smaller associated crime that was earned time eligible. And so people, I think, get confused when they say, well, how is it that the person who committed crime X is now getting out early? Well, they're not getting out early for crime X. They're getting out early for that underlying smaller associated crime to which they were always qualified and eligible for the 20% earned time, and were now by this legislation eligible for the increase in the 30%. And if there's confusion generally in the public, and this comes from, you know, dinner conversations that I've had with friends and others who are just not understanding sort of the technical aspects of how sentencing and charging practices and our general criminal justice system work, and they kind of have this notion that a guy who's committed crime X is serving, you know, nobody pays attention to the smaller underlying crimes at the time of sentencing or when the person's convicted. And those are the ones where they're likely going to be eligible for this additional earned time. And I think that's been where a great deal of the confusion and some of the consternation has come from in this bill. And I don't know particularly how you resolve that issue legislatively in a way that, other than trying to perhaps be more clear and educate people about Oregon's sentencing policy and how that works. But I think that's been the source of the greatest amount of confusion from my perspective, at least in the conversations and phone calls and media conversations that I've had over the last several months.
Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Williams has made a good point here, and that is in our sentencing structure, first off, it's the act, the crime, not the individual. So you're sentenced for the act, and what you have oftentimes is a sentence on the most serious offense, and then the court will give a consecutive sentence, meaning it starts to be served after the more serious one has been served. The more serious crime, a Measure 11 crime, the person is not eligible for any earned time at all. It's the second crime, the less serious one that's being run after consecutively, in which the judge at the time of sentencing on both crimes made the person eligible for 20%. So we now go back to have a hearing on that smaller crime, the non-Measure 11 crime, before the court for an additional 10%.
Another thing, a clarification, and Max, correct me if I'm wrong. Basically, what we passed in 3508 did not, let's say, grant anyone who was not already eligible for earned time in the current system to be eligible for earned time. All it did was saying that if you had the ability to earn up to 20%, you could, in fact, become eligible for an additional 10%. And so it did not create a new right or a new, let's say, earned time for inmates who were not already qualified and eligible for receiving the base 20%. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's basically, there's two statutes involved. There's ORS 137-750. That's the statute that tells a judge that they have the decision at the sentencing should this offender be eligible for earned time. And so anyone who, basically it's a check the box by the judge, yes or no. And so the box would have had to been checked, yes, this offender is eligible for earned time for them to be considered and have one of these notices go out. The other statute is ORS 421-121, and that's the statute that sets what's the maximum amount of earned time that an offender could earn. And that's the judge decides at original sentencing if they're eligible, and the maximum is statutory. And that's what this bill looked at for these certain crimes that are not excluded, the offender would be eligible for an additional 10% of earned time.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe you said that the average sentence reduction was 55 days. Do I have that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I believe for the nine, I think that's an accurate number with respect to the 900 or so that have been released, is I think the average sentence reduction was about 55 days.
I wonder if you could talk just a bit about what the research shows in terms of a correlation, if any, between early release and rates of recidivism. Is there research that shows that early release of, for example, 55 days increases, decreases, or is neutral on rates of recidivism?
Chair Przanski and Senator Bonamici, we certainly, because of the shortness of the time that this has been in place in Oregon, it's just been too early to determine any sort of even short-term recidivism rates with respect to the population that we're currently talking about. The one study that I am aware of, I'd comment for the record, as we've been looking at this issue, we've identified, I think, at least four or five other states that have made adjustments in their earned time policy in the last year or two as a result of budget pressures as they've been trying to balance their public safety financial issues. But the only one that I'm aware of that's done any sort of review has been the state of Washington. Washington increased their earned time for selected crimes from about 30%. Or 33%, I think, to 50%. They did do, the Washington Public Policy Research Institute folks did do a review of that earned time increase. I believe their process was done in 2007. They did a review of that, and my understanding is that they found essentially no increase in recidivism and arguably a small decrease in recidivism for the population that were released early as compared to the population that wasn't released early. But it was a pretty small percent reduction, so I think it would be fair to say, at least in that one study that we're aware of, they didn't see any significant increase in recidivism as a result of their increase in earned time. It is just one study. You can certainly make arguments that they're not particularly comparable given the different sentencing policies and structures in Washington versus Oregon. I mean, there's, you know, it's like any, you know, you've seen, you know, one state, you've seen one state sort of argument. So, you know, I'm not trying to hold that out as the definitive answer by any means to the question, but it is the only data that we're currently familiar with that's actually had any significant research done on it. We are tracking, obviously, the recidivism rates with respect to this population. Mr. Prince's shop at the Criminal Justice Commission is going to continue to follow those releases, and they'll have comparable data at some point in the future. But it's going to, recidivism is a lagging indicator, so it's going to take a bit of time to figure out whether or not we've seen an increase in recidivism that we think we can tie to this particular population getting an additional amount of earned time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, to follow up also, I might be also answering your question. Earned time is one of the things. If a person earns earned time, that is correlated with lower recidivism. There are a number of factors that are predictive of whether or not someone is going to recidivate. Some of them are things that people would call static factors. They don't change. Things like your age, your gender, some of your criminal history is very important. And in some of these things that folks at Department of Corrections or in this field called dynamic factors, changing things, earned time is one of the ones that you look at. And especially for younger offenders, if a young offender earns earned time, that is statistically correlated with reduced recidivism.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I'm going to move forward. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. All right, well, I'm going to do at this point, doing a time check, I'm going to go ahead and ask, Doug, did you want to come forward and make any comments for, and Mr. Steve, why don't you come on up, and Doug, I'm going to have you all go ahead and put some stuff on the record as you'd like to give us some information in general. I've got another group I want to bring up after that, and then we're going to probably shift into the other bill so I can get some informational stuff done on that, and we'll come back to this one.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, appeared in front of you many times in the last legislative session. I currently represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. The first point I want to make is that we are in favor of earn time. I believe earn time is a good approach in the correctional operation. The real question is, how much earn time? But I wanted to make that clear. We don't oppose earn time. Oregon system is a system that I believe is a generous system, and certainly in comparison to the federal system and some other states. But I wrote you a letter several weeks ago. It was sent to all legislators, and I basically made 7 points in that letter suggesting that you repeal this small portion of that big House Bill 3508. And where all the big money is was in the suspension, the delay, the repeal, whatever word you want to use for slowing down the implementation of Measure 57. This is relatively, I know $6 million sounds like a lot, it certainly is, it would be if it was a family budget. But it's a really small part. And as I think I made the point in my letter, and I suppose that Director Williams Craig Prince could say otherwise, but I think you save most of the money in this biennium already because of all the retroactive processing that's occurred fairly rapidly, and this caused a certain number of problems. Anyway, I don't want to repeat this letter. I do want to bring up one other point, though, that dawned on me here, frankly, just the other day. Oregon actually has the potential for 50% earn time.
Half off in certain cases.
And I think they turned my mic off when that happened.
It comes in and out. It's covered.
There is a program.
I don't think you shocked the speaker.
We have a program here in Oregon called the Alternative Incarceration Program. It's been around for a while, and Director Williams can certainly give you all the information about it. I couldn't find any data on either the Criminal Justice Commission website or the Department of Corrections website about it, but doesn't mean it's not there. It just means I didn't find it. But those programs are set up by statute, and people who go into an intensive program, drug or alcohol, or I'll use the word boot camp, although it's not described that way in the statute, can earn an additional up to 20% off their sentence. So that's 20% plus, it used to be 20%, so they could get 40% off, and now it's 30%, so they can get 50% off their sentence. And it's a select group, and Director Williams can tell you about that group. But we do have what I would suggest is a significantly generous system at 50% potentially off your sentence. I'm not arguing against those programs today. I haven't seen any data to know whether they're really good or not. Nor am I arguing against whether or not those programs reduce recidivism. I'm just telling you we have a 50% system already. And actually the reason I remembered this is because, and Director Williams may remember this, I wrote him a letter, because we had a police officer in Lane County back when I was district attorney. We had two of them, a guy named Magani and a guy named Lara. And they were both convicted of serious misuse of their office in a sexual way. And Laura got, I don't know, 6-7 years, didn't have time to go check the file. But he got into the program. And frankly, I don't know if he was successful or not. What I know is he got a lot of time off his sentence. And the law enforcement community and myself were upset with that he got so much time off. So I wrote Director Williams a letter about that, and that's what caused me to remember. So you can have the debate about whether or not the right people are going in, but it is a 50% system. So we don't just have a 30% system now. All right, I'm going to stop there because I sent you everything I could think of.
I appreciate that.
Steve, any comments you want to give us? Because we're going to move into some other.
I understand. Actually, we also at Crime Victims United support earned time, with the exception of the 23 or so, approximately 23 or so, first and second degree violent crimes covered under Measure 11. Everything else, we have over the years, you've never heard us complain about people getting 20%. The only time that Crime Victims United has come in and presented a testimony concerning earned time is when you were going to raise it. And the history, I think you, I also sent you a letter some time ago, the history shows that this has gone on every 2 years for the last 10 years. In some way, some fashion, someone has come in and wanted to increase earned time, whether it's on Measure 11 or sentencing guidelines, and we have opposed that. We think we have a very generous earned time process in this state with a 20%. As Doug said, most the federal government and most states have 15%. I know that Washington raised theirs to 50% for some crimes. I would point out to you, if you look very closely at their studies, those crimes that they gave people 50% for, many of those crimes, we don't even imprison people for in the state of Oregon. I think it's important to keep in mind that only 23%, according to the Criminal Justice Commission, of all convicted felons in the state of Oregon even go to prison. The other 77% fall under probation or local control. So those people are getting 50%. I think the other thing that's important to remember about what's happened in Washington is since they did that, there's been an additional 4.7 property crimes per offender under that program. So are we willing to take those kind of risks and increase our crime rates around property crime and the crimes actually committed by these offenders by giving increase where we got a very, where they got a very small decrease in the rate of recidivism, about 3.5%. They got an increase in property crime rates. I think these are all things to take into consideration. I one of the questions I would ask, I will never be, but if I was on the panel, if I was elected, is what has the defense cost been here? Because remember, every one of these defendants came in and got assigned a public defender. And I would be very interested to have somebody look into what these defense costs have been. As I said, I've written you a couple letters in the last couple weeks, but if I have to tell you, in terms of what's happened here, this has been extremely hurtful and extremely traumatic for crime victims. I have attended more of these hearings than I even want to remember at this point. And I have to tell you, from a procedural and process standpoint, from a standpoint of what it's done to human beings as far as victims go, and the political fallout of this, I think the only term I can think of is train wreck. But I'd like to leave you with this. If you don't remember anything else I said here today, I would like you to remember this. That from 95 to 2008, Oregon's violent crime rate decreased 49%. I think we should be very proud of that and what we've done with the criminal justice system in Oregon. That we've prevented, because of the rate of incarceration that we have in Oregon, we've prevented 100,000 crimes each year going forward since 1995. And last but not least, we rank 30th in the rate of incarceration in the United States. 30th. It's hardly what I'd call a penal colony that we've created here, as some would allude to. And last but not least, they say we're number one, or some say that we're number one in the rate of spending on incarceration in prisons in the state of Oregon. I have to ask a question here, and I challenge the great Pew in the sky, as they call it, the Pew organization, on this, because they're mixing apples and oranges. They compared us to other states, because some states, as you know, they separate their prisons and their community corrections budgets, where we lump them together in Oregon. But how can we be 30th in incarceration and number one in spending? And if we are, we really got a problem somewhere. So anyway, I'd ask you to consider that, and I appreciate very much you giving us the time to speak this morning.
All right, thank you very much. Were there any questions from this panel?
One last. We do, just so you know, I think you'll see it on the list, we do have some crime victims here to speak.
I understand. If you weren't here earlier, what I'm going to do is split time during the informational between the two bills that we have, and then we're going to come back and pick up additional testimony, so thanks.
Thanks so much.
I just want to get some people who I know that were tracking in the specifics, and I knew that you could give more of a generic as to, I'm assuming some of theirs is going to be more specific.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, let's see. Shannon, did you want to come up and make any statements for Partnership and Justice?
No, they're the coalition.
All right, then what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to take a break from this one on this informational hearing. We're going to move into the other bill so we can get the informational hearing. As for those who came in late, we cannot have the formal public hearings until 9:30. And so what we're trying to do is do informational hearings to gather information that which will be adopted as into the record, but to split the time so we can make certain we get both of the bills heard today, and hopefully we'll be able to move into work session on Thursday. I'm going to go ahead and recess the informational hearing on Section 17 of House Bill 3508, and I'm going to open up an informational hearing at this time on Senate Bill 603 that was passed during the 2009 session. And Council, you want to give us a little overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have Michael Slosson from DOJ, and I'd like to give my staff presentation when we open the public hearing, if that's okay.
All right. So, Michael, why don't you come on up, please?
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Michael Slosson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice. I'm going to provide some background information on Senate Bill 603 from last session and Senate Bill 1008 from this session. Under Oregon law, people who have been convicted of a felony crime are barred from possessing or purchasing a firearm. Under 603, it changed the law so that those people who are barred from possessing a firearm can apply for relief from that bar. So what 603 did, Senate Bill 603, was it allowed all felons, regardless of their criminal history, to apply for relief from the bar from possessing a weapon. And the bar, for purposes of our discussion, really takes form in two criminal statutes. Those two statutes, there's a felon criminal possession and a misdemeanor crime. Under the felony possession crime, there is an exception. There's a number of exceptions, but the relevant exception for purposes of our discussion is that people who have a felony conviction would not be guilty of the felon possession crime if they have only one felony. It's been over 15 years since they served a sentence on that felony. It wasn't a felony conviction involving a criminal homicide or a conviction involving the use of a firearm or a knife that swings open with centrifugal force. Those people would not be liable under the felony crime of possession, but they would fall into the scope of the misdemeanor crime of possession. 603 does not distinguish, or did not distinguish, between those two categories of folks. Regardless if you'd be liable under the felony statute, so you had a broader extensive criminal history, or the misdemeanor statute, you would be eligible to apply to have the relief applied to get relief from the bar from possession. My understanding is, and I was not involved early on in 603, my understanding was it was the initial reason for implementing 603 is to address what some have referred to as kind of an anomaly in the statutes, which was prior to 603, any convicted felon could apply for relief from purchasing a firearm, but could not, under any circumstances, apply for relief from possessing a firearm. And 603, as my understanding was, the initial intent was to sort of address some of those. But what it ended up doing, which was the unintended consequences, is instead of narrowing the scope of who could purchase and aligning those two, it actually opened the door to allow any felon, under any circumstances again, to apply for relief from the bar from possessing a weapon. So quite literally, a convicted felon could walk out of prison and apply for purchasing a firearm. In fact, really read literally, the application could be made while the felon was still incarcerated and essentially have the firearm waiting for him if that petition for relief was granted. What Senate Bill 1008 does is to limit the scope of who is eligible to apply. So, and it does it in a way for purchasing and possessing, so you will no longer have that what some people refer to as anomaly that Senate Bill 603 tried to alleviate. You will not have that anomaly anymore. You will actually have the same standards for possessing and purchasing a firearm. And what that would be is that those people who would not be subject to conviction under the felony crime of possession, but just a misdemeanor crime, those folks that fall out of the exception from the felony into the misdemeanor crime would be eligible to apply for relief from possession, apply from relief from the bar from possession. So those folks under 1008 that now would be eligible, as opposed to swinging the door broadly to every felon, those folks would be the people who have only one felony. It was over 15 years. It did not involve a criminal homicide, did not involve a firearm, and did not involve the use of basically a switchblade. And so what that bill does now then is to make it consistent with possessing and purchasing.
All right, thank you for the review. And I'm going to ask questions starting with Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe we should have Max ask this question or answer this question. This adds post-prison supervision, which is different from parole and different from probation. And remember, I'm not the lawyer here. So tell me what post-prison supervision is versus parole versus probation.
Chair Brzozowski, Senator Boquist. Okay, so parole
in the beginning.
Yeah. In the beginning we had.
1989, those folks would be considered parole when they're released from prison. Now, and I'm kind of doing this. I'm not Tim Sylvester from DOJ, so I don't know all of the sentencing
history. You're playing the part well, though.
What's that?
You're playing the part well.
Oh, thank you. So, and then after that, with the sentencing guidelines, you have post-prison supervision, which is a term of part of the sentence that's imposed when a person is sentenced after their term of in prison. Probation is as a term when somebody is not sentenced to a term of incarceration but sentenced to the supervision of a probation officer and they can serve jail as a condition. It was part of that. Is that
so for just a point?
Let me just say this. Basically, we shifted from a parole system into a post-prison supervision, but we do have Doug Harkerold here who could give us a little bit more if you want greater detail.
So Mr. Chair, just so I understand here, what we're really saying is that the term parole predates 1989, and that's what we used up until 1989, and then after 1989, we changed the name and whatever we're doing with it, and we now call it post-prison supervision.
Kind of like branding, a new branding.
Okay. All right. Follow-up question?
Yes.
Okay. Same question. DHS versus Oregon Health Authority. There obviously is a date-time group here in which DHS doesn't do it and didn't do whatever it was doing, and it's now doing it. Or Oregon Health Authority is going to do it now in the future. Is that correct? And what's that date time group?
Chair Brzozowski, Senator Boquist, that portion of the bill I was not involved in, so I could get back to the committee on that, but those particular dates was something that I know legislative council worked on and dealt with those. The portion I was involved in was more the policy-related question regarding 603 and 1008.
Yeah, just before you, my understanding, again, is a clarification, is that we had one system, one authority over who did the commitments, and then we renamed it, and it became something else, and so it's making certain that you cover whoever was the authority at the time that the commitment occurred.
Right, Mr. Chair, and I would assume that there's a date-time group in that, or something close, that we stopped doing it this way and started doing it that way, much like the post-prison supervision.
Mr. Chair, and this gets kind of into the detail of the bill, and I'm hoping we could do after the public hearing,
because okay,
I feel more comfortable about that on the record. But it's in the SMS about how in 2009 we passed 2853. Sorry, that's not 2853 part. In 2009, we changed civil commitments from DHS to Oregon Health Authority.
What was the date again?
2009, last legislative session.
Okay.
So when we created the Oregon Health Authority, we changed the authority for civil commitments to go to them. And so we wanted to make sure we captured the people who were committed under the DHS system and also the Oregon Health Authority system. That's where that part of the language came from.
Just for the record, I understand this may be touching on to the actual bill that we're going to be hearing through the public hearing, but at the same time, I see this as the chair as informational and as an appropriate question and in response. All right.
Okay. Last question, yes. Mr. Can you give me, thank you, Mr. Chair, any, we have a, I guess, a pre-603, post-603, and then something in the future if we had the ideal that we'll talk about later. Okay. Can you give us some background here? I mean, what's maybe just, what's the average of people trying to do something pre-603 versus post-603 for what we think is in the future? How many people are we really impacting? I mean, do we think?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Boquist, I can't give you general numbers, but I can kind of give you a world before and a world under 603. So before 603, if a person had a felony conviction, that person could apply for relief from the bar from purchasing a firearm, but under no circumstances could that person apply for relief from the bar from possessing it. The number of those folks that would involve is anybody who's convicted of a felony in the state. Under 603, any felon, any person convicted of a felony, it doesn't matter if it's a homicide, it doesn't matter the number of felonies, that person would be eligible to apply for the bar from relief from both purchasing and possessing. So it would apply to anybody, and as far as actual numbers, it'd be any convicted felon under any circumstances who wanted to apply would be eligible.
And Senator Boquist, just for your information, the pre-603, the petitions, the applications can go to justice courts. Justice courts are not courts of record. So there may be difficulty even being able to know how many people actually applied. Not that there's not some type of recording of it, but I'm not sure how much of that would be captured to be able to, without going to every justice court and having them open their files and look.
Follow-up question, since you raised that issue. And my understanding of the system, and I might be wrong here, and no disrespect to any cities, but I'll just pick some here, is that if you commit a felony, you have to go to a circuit court or a district court?
It's circuit court. That all of those, any felony has to be handled through either the district attorney's office or the Department of Justice. They have jurisdiction over felonies.
And so then the follow-up, my understanding, and this is really dating myself, when I was a kid, I mean, we used to go to the Justice of the Peace, you know, in the local city, whether it was like Tillamook or Garibaldi, and no disrespect, it was a rental lawyer who filled in and, you know, was the judge for that night.
And in many cases, not even a lawyer.
Okay. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a justice court, right? Like what the city of Maupin or the city of Garibaldi or something like
that. You have municipal courts, and those would be the city courts. Some of the city charters require the people who sit in those to be members of the bar, be legally trained. Others do not. And this, with the Justice Court, I don't know if any of them require to be legally trained, but that's, you know, comes back from the frontier days where you didn't have people who were legally trained and are sitting still today.
So point clarification, for purposes in the law, Justice Court would be like Justice of the Peace or Municipal Court or something like that. Got it. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Wesson.
Yes, thank you. Perhaps I didn't hear it, but I didn't hear you finish the answer to Senator Boquist's question, and that would have been under the scenario under post-603, if Senate Bill 1008 were to pass, then what would be the scenario then?
Chair Buzowski, Senator Whitsett. So after 603, the people who would be eligible to apply, as opposed to any person convicted of any number of felonies, it would be a narrow class of individuals who would not be prosecutable for the felony crime of possession of a firearm. So those would be folks who had only one felony conviction that was over 15 years old since any sentence or post-prison supervision or parole, and who did not commit a crime involving criminal homicide or the use of a firearm or basically a switchblade or a butterfly knife. Those folks who would fall outside the felony crime but would still be barred from possessing a firearm under the misdemeanor crime, those folks under the new legislation would be able to apply for relief with now a circuit court from that bar that they have under the misdemeanor crime. One little note that I didn't make on this is that this just deals with people with felony convictions, and so you have, under all of these rules, you do have that a circuit court now under the new one, or a justice court before, accepting the applications and reviewing the applications, because a person could have a fairly extensive misdemeanor criminal history and still be eligible to apply.
Okay, follow up. Then, if I understand it, then before 603, no felon could possess a firearm. Under 603, any felon could possess a firearm if he was granted that authority or that ability by a court. And post 603, under Senate Bill 1008, a narrow group of felons who were excluded from certain crimes and are barred by misdemeanor felony possession would be able, after 15 years, to apply for relief from the bar.
Chair Buzowski, Senator Whitsett, that's correct.
Thank you.
The one other little exception to that is they would be eligible to apply for expunction of their conviction before that, so they could, some of them could get it sooner than the 15 years.
All right.
One final question. Why 15 years? Is there some reason it's 15 years?
Well, the statute's already provided that automatically you would have the right to purchase at 15 years. And what we're trying to do, this is the whole thing, kind of bring this back as to when this bill came through the 09 session. I sat down with Kevin Sterlich, who will be testifying in a moment or giving us his perspective. And when I heard that the inequity there, that someone could actually have automatically get the right to purchase but couldn't possess, that was what the intent that I had, is trying to blend those together. So if you had the right to purchase, you would also have the right to possess, but you still had to go through the petition process. It's just, unfortunately, in the drafting, it made it broader than what I had contemplated and the other members that I've talked to. So any other questions for Michael? Can you stand by and be here if we have any other things that comes up?
Sure. And Chair Przanski, as I read it, I don't think, and I'll sit back and double check, but I don't think even under the purchasing it was automatic, you would still be required to apply for the relief.
Right. That, I think that's correct, too. Yes. All right. Kevin and Rod, you two want to come up and give us some perspectives?
Chair, I'm a member of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder, the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. I'll probably keep the bulk of my testimony for the public hearing, and I think there are a number of things already have been said that need correcting, but I'm going to wait until that public hearing takes place to go on record with that. I would agree with you, and this was a very, very sloppy drafting of this bill, and we used a howitzer for something that a fly swatter would have taken care of. Having said that, a little background on this bill. I was at every hearing on the bill last session. It went through this committee with no dissent. It passed the Senate the first time on a vote of 29-0. It went to the House. House Judiciary Committee listened to it, passed it out of there without dissent. It passed the House floor, 57-0, and it came back here and was repassed 28-0. I found it very difficult to comprehend how this bill made it all that way through all those hearings and through all that discussion without anyone bringing up this subject. If it was a burning issue, I would have thought it would have a little better vetting on during the process. The fact that, and I want to go on record as saying the NRA does not advocate that all felons should have guns, and so we'll talk about that a little bit later in the public hearing. Never during any of these hearings did I hear this matter discussed. There was no staff summary for the Senate that I could find, and in the House summary it only addressed those matters involving carrying a firearm in a vehicle. So I'll keep the majority of my comments for the public hearing, and a lot of things have to be cleared up that were said by the previous speaker on this issue and on the 15-year issue and some other things. So, thank you very much.
Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't remember ever working on a bill that got as much discussion as this one did, both with you guys individually and hearings. And I, as Mr. Harder said, I'm going to save most of my testimony for 108. But at no point in the discussions of this bill was this 15-year issue ever even brought up. As a matter of fact, the intention of this bill started in another bill that Senator Boqvist introduced for us that was going to address that one anomaly. And there appears to be this unending confusion between two sections of Oregon law. That's 270 and 274. And the confusion about the 15-year issue versus the petition for relief. The 15-year issue says nothing about you can buy it, but you can't own it. That has nothing to do with that. The 15-year issue says that after 15 years of a person being off parole, post-prison supervision, or whatever you're calling it now, that person doesn't petition for anything. He gets his rights back automatically. But that still doesn't work, because he only gets his rights back to not be called a felon in possession, and then he gets dinged with unlawful misdemeanor possession. That has nothing to do with the issue about petitioning for relief, which also, prior to 603, made no sense. And Chairman Przanski, I have an email here that I sent to you on April 2nd where we discussed in painful detail what the problem was with the current law that a person could buy it and not own it. And we wanted to fix that. We wanted to fix the mistake in the 15-year issue as well. The reason I don't think we ever addressed the 15-year issue was because a couple of bills were introduced in the House. I believe they were introduced, I know for a fact they were introduced at the request of the criminal defense attorneys, that addressed that problem. But then for whatever reason at the hearing, people decided that the bill didn't do what they wanted it to do, and those bills both died. But there was an effort made on the other side of the building to address the 15-year issue. 573, the bill that Senator Przanski introduced for us, addressed the buy but not own issue. And I don't understand. I mean, apparently it's not clear, but they're two totally unrelated issues, and the attempt to fix the buy but not own thing, I simply cannot accept that with all the discussions we had, both personally in committees, through emails, then getting through all the places it got through, including a House committee full of lawyers, that this is all a grand mistake. The Department of Justice, who aren't telling us now what the intent of the bill was, were never there for any of the hearings or any of the discussions, and didn't have any complaint until after you guys passed it, they passed it, and the governor signed it. Now, in no way are we advocating that felons be handed guns, but that doesn't happen. The Justice Court issue might be something that needs correction, but the fact is, I only know of one instance, and this is what I know, of a person applying to get his rights restored. And the court said, no way, you're not going to do it, come back in 10 years. The fear that murderers and rapists are going to walk out of prison and then go to court and ask for permission to get a gun just doesn't add up to me. And so I just have to take issue with the idea that all that went into this bill was just a massive oversight. And I don't believe the correcting bill is a whole other problem. But I don't believe the bill does anything other than what it said it did was clarify something in Oregon law that simply didn't make sense. I don't believe it was the intention of the legislature to let somebody buy something they couldn't own.
Questions?
All right, Rod, the one thing, since you stated that you attended most of the hearings, or if not all of the hearings, on these various bills that came in to B603, if I remember correctly, the readily accessible part of the bill is where the focus was during the most of the testimony. This more got a cursory review as to the nominee needing to pair up where someone could actually not be in violation of unlawful possession. And that was just kind of like a side part. Is that what you remember, or do you remember it differently?
Mr. Chair, that is the way I remember it. That's correct. That's the way we remember it. And the discussion around being able to possess took a number of different tangents. But this other business, that the section of the law which is under attack now, to my remembrance, was not discussed, at least in depth.
And what I remember is that we actually had multiple bills, multiple subjects that we were looking at, and we blended them into one toward the end of session. Now, I know that we passed this early enough to get it through the process, but prior to the bill actually being signed by the governor, we were alerted as to the mistake that was done in the what SB 1008 will be before us to modify and fix. Chair Barker and I, Chair Barker being the House Judiciary, we talked about it, and we didn't know of any bill that we had that we could actually make the change to fix the inaccuracy of what we intended to have passed in 603. And we also were briefed that because of the starting date, when it went into effect would be January 1 of this year, that there'd be approximately 30 days that this window of opportunity would be open before we could come back and address it. And the two chairs, myself being one of them, chose not to try to do anything in the closing days or closing week of the session to try to clarify that, and knew that we're going to be coming back to address this at this time. All right, any other comments, thoughts? Senator Wessett, you got something on your mind?
Since apparently both chairs knew that there was a difficulty with this bill, why wasn't the rest of the committee made aware of that, sir?
Well, we weren't going to take anything up at the last week of session. There was no time to do anything else. If we had known about it before it actually went through either of the sides, I guarantee you we would have taken care of it.
Did I misunderstand you? I thought you said that you were alerted that there was a problem with this bill before it was voted on in chambers.
Did not say that. What I said was before it was signed by the governor.
It was passed by both chambers before, is it? Okay.
Absolutely.
Then I withdraw my question.
All right. Anything else?
I'd just like to point out to the right, this is the Senate being engrossed. And in the bold text of the summary, it says modifies who may petition for relief from bar. And so I don't think that issue was ignored.
No one said it was ignored. It's just how it got drafted. We assumed that it did what we intended it to do, and it didn't do that.
Well, no,
so that's why we're back.
What I was commenting on, Mr. Chairman, was your comment to Mr. Harder about how most of the discussion was about the readily accessible language.
Well, have you listened to the tapes?
Yes.
In their entirety?
Well, I've been listening to a lot of tapes lately.
You might want to listen to all the tapes, because I had staff go through those to find out exactly how much. And what I've been told is what was on there was very little regarding this portion, that the vast majority, as Mr. Harder said, was on the readily accessible, that you and I talked multiple times in crafting the language, which we're actually going to make another modification under Senate Bill 108. 2008 to take care of another issue that wasn't clarified regarding ATVs.
Right, and motorcycles. But
correct.
As I said earlier, the elements of this bill that are now in dispute were incorporated into 603.
We know that.
By yourself.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
All right, so we're at 9:25. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a short recess of 5 minutes. We're going to come back right at 9:30. We're going to come back in, and at that point, we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearings on both of these bills. So we'll take a short recess. Please be back in 5 minutes. I want to call this back to order, and at this time we're going to start our public hearing, open a public hearing, and on Senate Bill 1008.
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1008 removes the ability for all felons to petition a court to be allowed to purchase and possess firearms, allows felons who have been released from prison for more than 15 years to petition a court to purchase and possess a firearm if the conviction did not involve a firearm or a switchblade knife or criminal homicide. It adds references to the Department of Human Services to cover civil commitments that occurred before the law changed in 2009 to require civil commitments by the Oregon Health Authority. It removes the requirement that asset forfeiture counsel send a copy of each judgment to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee. It contains duplicative language and effective dates to comply with House Bill 2853, passed in 2009. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment adds language to ORS 166270 to clearly state that if a felon is barred from possessing a firearm but has only one felony that is 15 years old that did not involve a firearm or switchblade knife or criminal homicide, they are allowed to petition a court to possess a firearm under ORS 166274. It removes the ability to petition a justice court and instead only allows petitions in circuit court. It treats motorcycles, all-terrain vehicles, and snowmobiles as vehicles that have no trunk for purposes of whether a firearm is readily accessible. The firearm must be in an enclosed lockbox. It adds language to cover civil commitments that are either from the Department of Human Services or the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Rod, Kevin, I'd like you two to come back up, and Dave Ainsberg, why don't you come up as well? I'm going to have three up here. And gentlemen, you have about 7 minutes between the two of you to get us what you need, because I'm going to need to move into the public hearing on the other.
Rod or Kevin, whoever, do you want to go?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm an Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. Before we start, I do want to get on record. There have been a number of emails floating around and form letters and whatever back and forth. Two things I want to state very clearly. NRA does not advocate that all felons should have access to firearms. And I did not and do not support this bill moving forward. Bill 603, we already know what Mr. Sterrett's bill, so I'm not going to allude to that during my testimony except a couple of times. Senate Bill 603 is current law, passed from this committee last session, and I went through the numbers.
Rod, I'm going to ask you to summarize. We have your written testimony. I'm on a stream okay. time deadline, so if you can just summarize.
This is a bad bill. It is very confusing. There is no way you can read this bill and understand what it said. We're taking 43 pages to correct a 5-page bill. If you're confused by 603, you're going to be really astounded by this work. It does not grant felons the ability to go out of jail and get a gun. That's not what this does. It sends them before a court. They're required to go to court. Yes, any felon can petition. But where are the records as to how many did before 603 for 20 years? We don't have any of those. And we know of one incident for sure that's taken place since 603 went into effect. Before 603, a number of and this is not anything new. Somewhere I've heard that any felon can petition. Before 603, there were a group of felons who could petition. And I'm not going to list them. They're listed in my handout. But the main one we're concerned with, and I may be wrong on this, but the way I read this new bill is that the 15-year automatic termination of a felony goes away with this bill, and that becomes a prerequisite to petitioning. That's a major policy change, and major policy changes shouldn't be discussed during a mini session. And if I'm wrong, I'd like to know about that. But if I heard you correctly in the last discussion you and I had, you wanted that automatic termination to cease. And as I read 1008, it does do that. It makes it a prerequisite for a felon to file. With all of this discussion and the shortage of time here, I'm not going to go into my written testimony very much, but I'm going to say, right again for the record, We're not going to have to worry about overloading the courts like your other bill does. A felon wants a gun, seriously, he's going to go out and steal it like they do every day. During our discussions previously, I recommended that current law stay in place and that a well-thought-out, fair, reasonable bill be developed during the interim to address the problems. I also suggested that you bump up the requirement to petition to a circuit court and do away with the justice courts. Senator Boquist and I have had that discussion very briefly this morning, and I would continue to accept that premise and sending it to a circuit court, but I do not support this bill going forward.
Thank you. Kevin?
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation, and like Mr. Harder, for the record, I just want to state, in spite of what's been reported, neither I nor anyone in my organization either chose to distribute, quote, or distributed any inaccurate information about this bill, nor did I ever say at any time that I supported this bill going forward and being fixed in 2011. I will tell you currently, 603 simplified a law that most people do not understand, including police and including district attorneys. I spoke to the district attorney of Yamhill County last week and asked him to clarify some comments he made last session. It was his understanding that after 15 years, under certain conditions, a felon's right to have a firearm is restored. That's not correct. He did not understand that at the time. I have a recording from a district attorney in Jackson County who misunderstood a completely different section of Oregon gun laws. They are very, very complicated. People are very confused by them. 603 simplified them tremendously. And 1008, I've got to be honest with you, I've read this bill a dozen times, and there's still parts of it that I simply cannot understand. And if it's enacted, I cannot imagine the people who couldn't understand the existing law before 603 understanding what we're going to have with 1008.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make one addition, if I could, please. There's no reason to add ATVs and snowmobiles under the section that you're adding for motorcycles. ATVs and snowmobiles and firearms being carried there on are currently covered under ORS.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, David Amesbury for the Benton County District Attorney's Office. Mostly I wanted to be available for the committee in case it has any questions of me. I have the perhaps dubious distinction of having brought this what I perceive to be a glitch to Senator Brzozinski's attention. It was during the last week of the session. It's my understanding that the bill had already gone to the governor for signature before this was discovered, but it was too late in the session for a fix to be propounded. As far as the merits of Senate Bill 1008, the District Attorneys Association and our office both have concerns about allowing felons immediately upon release from incarceration to be able to apply for restoration of their right to possess a firearm, regardless of their criminal history and regardless of how long they were incarcerated, how long they've been out. The previous law had a 15-year buffer to avoid prosecution for a felony, and that seems to be an appropriate amount of time, but really is a policy choice for this committee. It appeared from my initial review of the bill right before signee die, after it had been signed, that this was an oversight. It didn't appear from the legislative history that I reviewed that it was the intent of the legislature to eliminate any waiting period from the time of a felony conviction until restoration of gun possession rights. That's why I brought it to the attention of the committee. So again, I have reviewed Senate Bill 1008. It appears to address the concerns that we had. I have reviewed the Dash 1 amendments as far as the reference to circuit courts as opposed to county courts, and that appears to be an appropriate resolution just because of the difficulties with having such serious matters addressed in county courts.
All right, thank you. I'm going to ask if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on SB 1008 that didn't sign up. What I'm going to do is go ahead and close the...
Can you just refer back to the information?
Yeah. At this point, for clarification, we had an informational hearing that started earlier this morning at 8 o'clock for two bills, our two subject areas that are now bills before us. We are incorporating and adopting the information we received from those individuals that came forward earlier today into the public record for each of the bills, Senate Bill 1008, and we'll be doing the same through this notation for 1007. With that, we'll close the public hearing on 1008, open the public hearing on 1007. And what we've done is, again, adopt or incorporate the testimony that information that's come in through the informational hearing. And what I have is, looks like a couple of different panels. So the first panel I'm going to call up, trying to get people together, Melissa Unger, Dana Heffer, and Mannion Haynes, or Hayes?
Marion.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, and Count, I'm going to have Bill give us some background. And the other thing, as we're getting set here, realize that I have committee members that are going to need to leave at 10 o'clock, so we need to keep our comments as short as possible. The chair will stay for a little bit longer to try to complete some of the hearing because of the urgent, the time limitations we have for this mini session. Ladies, whoever would like to start.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm a political organizer for SEIU Local 503, and I'm also a member of the Promise of Measure 57 Coalition, which all of the panel members here today are. And I want to start off by actually thanking the legislature and the people who voted for House Bill 3508 for passing that bill. As you know, our interest as the Service Employees Union in that bill was the cost savings that it provided for critical public safety programs, such as domestic violence programs, 24-hour police, and a facility for the Oregon Youth Authority in Burns, which was important for us. And we believe that that bill overall, at a time of budget cuts, was very smart and really looked at how we save money in the public safety programs that were needed. And we want to thank and support all of the people who voted for that bill. Since the passage of House Bill 3508, it's become apparent that there needs to be a couple improvements to make sure that the bill has its desired effect of increasing earned time for nonviolent crimes, and we believe that Senate Bill 1007 makes those changes to ensure that the bill is actually having the impact that it was intended to. And so we actually are here supporting Senate Bill 1007 as a way to make sure that the bill that was passed during the 2009 session is able to, we are able to focus on the success of the bill at decreasing costs, funding public safety programs, and beginning a study of the effectiveness of earned time. And so we look forward to continuing to work on this bill in the future, and we think that these changes are appropriate and adequate to make sure that we can make the improvements that have become apparent that people want, and we support these amended changes. So thank you for your support again, and I can answer any questions after the rest of the panel goes.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Dana Hepper. I'm the advocacy director with Stand for Children. And last session, we also supported House Bill 3508, the 2009 Safety and Saving Act. And now we're here supporting the amendments that are offered to that bill in Senate Bill 1007. We're here basically because if we want to fund the services and education that Oregon's children need in order to be successful in life, we've got to control our growing prison costs. The 2009 Safety and Saving Act approach of increasing earn time for certain targeted prisoners and studying the economic and public safety impacts of those changes begin to help put the public safety system back in balance in terms of its costs. If we don't balance our public safety spending, we put our children at risk. And just a couple programs in the public safety arena that are critically important to kids that whose funding is always in jeopardy are, we invest $10 million to help mothers stay with their children while going through treatment, which provides needed consistency instead of having DHS assume custody for those children during that time. Similarly, Representative Barker and Senator Shields have played a key role in increasing funding for needed domestic violence services in the Department of Justice budget. But if we aren't balancing the public safety spending, we, again, run the risk of losing services like those, and more women and children will be left in a cycle of domestic violence, which obviously isn't good for those children and families and isn't good for Oregon's long-term health as a society. These are just a couple of the reasons why we supported the 2009 Act. in House Bill 3508, and similarly, we support the changes in Senate Bill 1007 this time around. That's it.
Thank you. Mayor?
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. We, like the other members of the coalition, were part of that mainly because we were concerned with the growing costs in the corrections budget. If you look over the past number of years, the corrections budget is growing quite significantly in a much faster clip than what we think are other important investments the state needs to make, like higher education. We currently spend more money incarcerating folks than we do educating our young people in our higher education system. And so, like the rest of the panel, we support these technical changes here to accomplish what we were trying to do, to make sure that we're getting all of the savings that we can out of the correction system while still maintaining that core public safety function that we need to do for our citizens and our businesses in the state. And we think we need to go ahead and move forward with these changes, take the opportunity to do the studies and see how this is working. If changes are needed later, that can happen. But we very much support this bill, and thank you.
Senators, what I'm going to ask is to hold questions. Each of these panelists should be available since they're representing groups, and they can come by and talk to you. We've got two panels I need to get in. If you can hold it, if it's something that you think needs to be on the record right now.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to make sure I understand it myself.
Okay.
I mean, HB 3508, of course, we implemented, and it decreased the cost because we gave earn time. And 107 is going to increase some of those back, which is going to mean it's going to cost us more money, so we're going to have to fund it somehow. That's correct, right?
Well, it just means that the savings that were projected will be less than what we anticipated because we're narrowing the field of those who would be eligible for the additional 10%.
Correct, Mr. Chair, which means that this money's got to come from someplace. That's just to make sure I understand the basic premise here.
Thank you very much. My next panel I'm going to call up is it Elaine Primo, Mike Brown, and Mary Botkin. First thing I'm going to ask you to do is not to read your written testimony. We will look at it. I need you to please summarize. We have about 10 to 15 minutes before I'm going to lose members.
Who wants to go first?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Michael Q. Brown. I've been a police officer for over 30 years. I'm currently the president of American Federation State County, Municipal Employees Local 1847. I come here today as a father, the loving and caring, committed father, a murder victim, Cassandra Brown. We called her Cassie. She was born November 15, 1984. Cassie was a compassionate and caring person. She was always doing things for other people. She loved being active within her family. She attended Portland Community College and had a 4-point grade point average. On January 4, 2003, Cassie was invited to go out for the evening with her former boyfriend, Ben Kramer. Cassie had known Ben for over 7 years and had gone to school with him. Cassie knew that Ben was having problems and more than likely met him to help him. We would never see Cassie again. On the morning of January 6, two Portland police detectives, Lynn Courtney and Cheryl Kanzler, knocked on our door. I could tell by the look in their eyes that Cassie was gone. You cannot imagine what it's like to be told your daughter is never coming home again. There'll be no more birthdays, no more Christmases together. You'll never hear her voice again, hear her laugh, receive a hug. I would never walk down the aisle with her at her wedding or read bedtime stories to her children. Now imagine what it's like to tell my surviving daughter, Jenny, that her sister was brutally murdered, to tell Cassie's loving grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins, each time that you were traumatizing them and sending them into a nightmare that would last the rest of their lives. Through the dedication, hard work, and commitment by the Portland Police Bureau, they were able to determine what had happened to Cassie. Then Kramer had struck my daughter with a bottle. He had strangled her with a bungee cord, and he had dismembered her body. Then Kramer placed Cassie in two separate duffel bags, placed them in his car, and transported them to Kelly Point Park, where he threw the duffel bags containing Cassie into the Columbia Slough. One bag was recovered by Multnomah County Deputy Sheriff Joe Graziano. He was a diver. The other was later recovered in the Washington coast. Imagine choosing a casket for your daughter. Imagine having to speak at her services and place her behind a cold green marble at the Portland Mausoleum. All my family and I have is memories, photos, and tapes. My wife, daughter, and two-year-old granddaughter met with District Attorney Mike Schrunk in Multnomah County. We agreed that if Ben Kramer pled guilty to murder and abuse of corpse, we would not pursue aggravated murder charges against Ben Kramer. We did not want to traumatize our family anymore by a lengthy trial. Through years of counseling and support for brothers and sisters in law enforcement and the union, friends and family, we worked hard to recover as best that we could. You have no idea how crime victims and their families have been re-victimized all over again by the passage of this bill. All the pain has resurfaced within victims' families, including my own. As a police officer, I know the majority of these released early will victimize others. The best example of this is the recent murder of the four police officers in the state of Washington. The killer had been paroled early. Now, those responsible for the killer's early release have to live with what they have done for the rest of their lives. Those police officers will never go home to their families. We do not know the names or the faces of the victims yet, but once released, there will be more victims, and they will have families like mine, and they will suffer too. There will be the crimes that they will commit that they will get away with. The crimes that they commit where they are determined as a suspect, they will be a threat to the police officers conducting the investigations. Tax dollars spent on police time pursuing them, DA's office time prosecuting them, court costs, and corrections costs will all be a factor and cost us more tax dollars. This bill will cost us more tax dollars, and how do you place a price on the mental and physical pain the victims and the mental pain that their families will suffer, including innocent children? I strongly urge you to repeal House Bill 3508. Thank you.
Thank you for coming forward today. Elaine, are you ready?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for letting us come before you. It's a sad state when crime victims have to come before the legislature and say, let's do something right. We've already done damage through House Bill 3508.
Elaine, I need you to state your name on the
record.
Oh, I'm
sorry. So my name is Elaine Primo, and to give you a little bit of information about me as well. I was a 17-year veteran with the Oregon Department of Corrections and executive manager at least six of those years. I am currently a professor of criminal justice at Chemeketa Community College, and I am currently working on my PhD in criminal justice. I think I have some credentials when it comes to this issue. My most important job is Cassie Brown's aunt. And so I'm here to clear up a couple of, I think, mistakes. With all due respect to Director Williams, I have spent 17 years inside the Department of Corrections, and I've worked with the offenders. I've advocated for their change. We actually have a very generous system already when it comes to earn time. And he made a statement that said, when you ask him about whether or not they should change the wording, and he said, it doesn't really matter to me. And I have to admit, it should. As professionals for the Department of Corrections, we have dedicated ourselves to public safety, which means holding offenders accountable, giving them reasonable opportunities for motivation. We offer them education. We offer them treatment. We offer them recreation. They have plenty of opportunities to change their behavior. We already have an earned time program that goes as high as 20%, and I think that's adequate. I think it's very sad that agencies will look at cost savings by sending these offenders exactly what they want. Give them more free time out of prison, and the victims have to come here and beg you to reconsider this decision, this bill. Mr. Prinz talked about earned time and its relationship to recidivism, and let's not confuse the data. It can be manipulated to anybody's, you know, benefit. The data talks about treatment. It talks about work. It talks about disciplinary behavior in the prison system. Earned time is merely an incentive to try to get them to do all those things. That's what we're measuring. To just say, let's cut somebody out of jail, you know, 10% early because we think it's going to change recidivism is a misrepresentation, a gross misrepresentation. So please don't be confused by that. I did submit emails to many of the legislators, senators, and representatives, but I received one email back, and I think it shocked me more than anything else. It was a form letter, but basically it was from Representative Hunt, and he said that he believes that House Bill 3508 and then the Senate Bill 1007, he believes that the law has fulfilled its main objective, not to rehabilitate, not to really change recidivism. He said the main objective was to save dollars. Now, that's a sad state in Oregon. If we're going to put victims up here and have them beg you to repeal a bill, or at least this part of the bill, that is so painful and damaging to our families. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Mary, if I can keep your comments very short.
My comments will be very short. Council 75 is supporting the changes to 3508. We have some inherent conflicts with earned time. Earned time is a valuable tool for us, for our members who work inside the correction system. And at the same time, we find that the unintended consequences with what occurred with 3508 have been painful to other members. And several of us were with Mike from the very beginning of Cassie's disappearance, her subsequent murder, and the pain and the trauma that beset Michael and his family as the details were released about Cassie's horrific death. And we knew Cassie. Many of us watched Cassie grow up. And so it was more than just Michael's loss. It was a loss to us personally as well. Having said that, clearly, earned time needs to continue in some form, but we need to go back to what earned time is for, and that is earned time. Not an automatic prison sentence reduction, but rather the need of an inmate to earn that time off through their behavior and maintaining program vigilance that is required to get that earned time. Currently, it seems that earned time has become an automatic prison reduction or a sentence reduction rather than a reward for staying on your program and going through some rehabilitative process. And, you know, we just think that as the committee looks at this and looks at the corrections, that they also look at the corrections in the system that will go back to making this an earned time program rather than an automatic sentence reduction. So we'll be happy to work with the committee as they work their way through this process.
All right, thank you. Regarding questions, I'm going to see if there anyone has any questions for Mr. Brown or Ms. Primo. If not, Mary, if there's questions, I would expect the senators will contact you. Thank you very much for coming forward today. The last panel I have is Alan Tremaine, I believe. Heather, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to even try to pronounce your last name. I'm going to just butcher it, so, and then Ann Pratt. Those are the other three that are signed up. They didn't sign up. No. And just to give you warning, some of my members may need to leave because it is after our hours, and so please don't think they're being discourteous. They just have other obligations they have to go to because of the priorities that were set before the hearing. So whoever wants to go first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Alan Tremaine. I want to thank you for letting me speak here freely to you. Last night, I wrote some notes, but I'm just going to tell you my story. I am the stepfather of Kimberly Powell, or Kimber McDaniel. She's known as Kimberly Powell in the media. She was jogging on July 14th of 2006 on a small road just north of Columbia River. She was struck by a car and left in the blackberry bushes to bleed, suffer, and die. The person left. She had a ruptured jugular vein, and she was trying to get out of the blackberry bushes. The elderly couple found her or saw something moving and provided help, and she was put into a drug-induced coma and rushed to the hospital. My wife and I went to the hospital. Her head was three times bigger than a normal head should be. She, her eyes could be replaced by baseballs. It was the worst thing you could ever see. When her mom, Janet Tremaine, saw her, she collapsed and she had to be helped out of the room. For the next 30 hours, Kimberly fought for her life, but due to lack of blood and oxygen to the brain, she died. Talked to the doctors, and what they told me was if she would have received medical treatment right away, it would have been a 50-50 chance of survival. But due to the blood, lack of blood and oxygen to the brain, she only had a 5 to 10% chance to live. During that time, her skull was removed. It was horrible. Once she passed away, my wife, Janet, had to be blindfolded and taken into the room and placed on her daughter's body so that she could feel her love on her and say goodbye. For 5.5 months, we did not know who killed Kimberly. Our story was all over the media. It was horrible. We could not function. Our detectives asked us to set up a reward, and we did, and that caused Rosendo Gonzalez to run to Mexico and flee our state. He told a relative, and that relative verified it and called our detectives that next day. He sat in Mexico, and we figured out who he was, where the car was, but we could not touch him. It became a federal case, and it would take 2 to 4 years to get him back across the border. We stopped doing interviews, and he came back to work in the United States in California, and he was arrested on the exact 1 year day that he committed the crime. It was a long process. On January 23rd of 2008, we all sat in the courtroom and read our impact statements. This man received 59 months and will be deported back to Mexico. And it wasn't fair, but we thought we were done. My daughter, who was 14 at the time, was sitting in the courtroom only 10 feet away from the man that killed her daughter, her sister. 2 weeks after the trial, on February 4th, Stephen Farr, who just got done serving a sentence for burglary one, was out on a work release for a week. Him and his friend gave drugs to my 14-year-old daughter in Beaverton and raped her. Stephen Farr raped her. She became pregnant, contracted an STD, and she started falling apart. She didn't tell anybody what had happened to her. She then had a miscarriage, and she started cutting herself, hearing voices, and attempted suicide. When she found out, I rushed her to a hospital where she stayed for over a year and a half. We found out what had happened, and it took 6 months to build a case against Stephen Farrar and his friend, Stephen Rivers. Stephen Farrar was arrested for 7 felony counts, but pled down to sex abuse 2 and providing a controlled substance to a minor. He received 29 months. If my daughter was 5 months younger, it would have been a major 11 offense, and it would have received 25 years. I did not want to put my daughter through this again, so, you know, we accepted the deal, and I had to go through trial again, and my daughter was able to write her impact statement and face the judge to tell him what had happened and how that changed her life. Stephen Clay Rivers, who provided the drugs, he received 5 years probation, and during that time, he has to register as a sex offender. We went to court, and that was the deal. 4 months later, I was back into court because he violated his parole and stole something, and he was sentenced to 16 months. House Bill 3508 was already in place, so I'm sitting in the courtroom, and he automatically received that 30%. I was not in a state that I could understand what was going on. When several months have passed, I tried to work. I could not work. We could not function. We received a phone call from the DA stating that the man that murdered Kimberly, we had to go to court. He was eligible for 3508, not for the criminal neglect homicide hit and run, but for not performing the duties of a driver. It put us back in the state. You could not imagine what me and my wife went through. My wife and I went to court, and she read an impact statement, and you could feel the words. If you have time, Mr. Chair and committee, you could see her picture on the front page of the Oregonian or look at the news of her trying to say what she had to say. It put us back in the place all over again. When we got home, we watched the news, and one of the statements that was on the news is that House Bill 3508 did what it was supposed to do because he was denied. But it didn't take account of what it did to me and my family and everybody around us. You'd think that was over, but no. The man that raped my daughter was now up for 30% off, and he received it. Not for the sex abuse too, but for providing drugs for the minor. I just plead with you, this House bill has done so much to me and my family. I have spent everything I had to keep my daughter alive and in the hospital while she was trying to kill herself. They told me if she was released, she would kill herself. I took out a third mortgage, got every credit card I could find just to keep her alive. It cost me $500 a day, and I'd do it again. I want to thank you, and that's my story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Heather.
Mr. Chair and the committee, members of the committee, my name is Heather Struznik. I've considered myself every day a survivor and not a victim. On October 20th of 2007, of a serial sadist rapist, James David Worley, who was on parole for his second offense. His prior records had been lost, so he was not, those were not ever brought up. He chose not to speak during my trial, so his priors never came up again. On that night, I was assaulted in my vehicle by him. He was on meth, 6'1", 215 pounds. He entered my vehicle and said he was going to kill me, and I had a 45-minute fight for my life, and I believed he was going to do that. I had 45 2-inch knots all over my front of my head and the back of my head, concussions, broken nose, broken jaw. I have a bulging disc in my neck. I was ripped from my vehicle after being strangled and smothered to cause me to pass out, I apparently, ripped by my hair from my vehicle, third of my hair ripped out, holding on to my Jeep, I had all my fingers severed to the bone,
He attempted to try to stab me to death with a, or excuse me, stab me with a screwdriver. Fortunately, it was backwards in his pocket. Fortunately, when he got it out, I had kicked him off of me and was able to make attempt to flee, in which I was grabbed by my hair, face down, on the ground, being drugged face down. I grabbed my tow bar on the back of my Jeep. This is after 35 minutes of being beaten in my vehicle, repetitively being told I was going to be killed. I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. I was able to try to reach out in the road. A car went by. Little did I know it was an off-duty police officer who did not see me and did not stop. My fingers were bleeding. My nose was broken. My eye was bulging. I couldn't see. I was gashed and cut on my face. Blood was running down my face. My hair was stuck in my face. I was clawing the road to try to stay with my vehicle. I flipped over, tried to kick at him. He was dragging me off the road. Fortunately, again, by these two fingers, I was able to reach with them being severed and grab my edge of my door of my vehicle and pull myself, digging with my knees and digging and fighting, being pulled by the hair and kicked in my back and beaten on my head and the back of my body, I was able to get back to my vehicle. The entire time I fought courageously and I fought valiantly. I was never a victim and I never begged for my life. I never pleaded for anything. I spoke scripture. I commanded this man to take his hands off me. I fought hard and I fought strong. And I said, I would have rather die than have you touch me. And I meant it. And I was willing to die. And I felt like I was going to. At that point, when I got back to my vehicle, I pulled myself back up. I stood up and I screamed. I mean, just a righteous anger at the top of my lungs. I was infuriated. He stopped and he was breathing heavily over my shoulder. At that point, I had no strength left. I knelt to die, putting my hands between my forehead. I said my last prayers. At that point, a calmness came over me, and I had nothing to lose, but I turned to him, and I said, I'm so sorry for ever hurt you. I know you're going to kill me, but please let me say something first. I said, God loves you, and I forgive you for what you're about to do. I'm so sorry for this anger in you. It must come from a lot of pain. I understand that anger, because I've been through a lot of pain. I've been through a lot of suffering. I continue to survive every day. That's why I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor. And I turned to him and I pled to him for his own life. You know, and not for my own, but I said, you know, I respectfully said, I'm so sorry for whatever's happened to you. And I turned to him and I said, I'm a mother. Do you love your mother? I'm somebody's mother. My baby needs me. I'm a mother of a 18-year-old son now, he's in college, who had to endure witnessing that night his mother coming home beaten. My jaw was out of place, my face bloody pulp, my hair, I mean just, I had already started with poison oak over 2/3 of my body from hiking. So I was already, and my body was already in distress. So with all the lacerations and the cutting, it was an awful mess. But he let me go. He said, I just need to get my glasses. I'm gonna let you go. Apparently he loves his mother. He hates women, but he loves his mother. I ran down the road. Another car was coming. It was the second police officer off duty who did not see me in the fog. It was 2 a.m. and foggy, and skid in the middle of the road. I was stopped. I was willing to be hit and run down versus be there with that man for one moment more. He went by me, hit me on the side, it knocked me to the ground. By the time the police officer, I didn't know he was a police officer until my court day, but he skid and he stopped right outside my vehicle. Whirly was on the other side. I screamed, running for my life, saying, thank you, God, I'm saved, I'm saved, I'm saved. He rolled down his window and he said, I'll be right back, and he left me. And I had to plead for my life at that point with Whirly. I went, well, here it goes. You know, he came around and faced me and I said, I wasn't going to tell. I just need to get help. You're doing the right thing. I placed my hand up on his shoulder where my blood seeped into his raincoat that had cotton liner, which is the only DNA evidence they were able to find. And I talked him down the second time. I began to feel my body was shaking violently. I was in medical. I'd quit my job and was in medical assisting school for 2 months. I had alimony at that time. I was going to be able to finish and make something, be able to be be able to be in the workforce and a supply for my family, in which now I had $40,000 in the bank. Now I have nothing. I took off today. I have a minimum wage job that I have less than part-time hours. I'm looking for employment. But this is how it's devastated my life. But yes, at that night, I was able to talk him down. They took him away. I was able to keep my wits about me, memorize the license plate, and give him to the state after a third time that he's done this, that he's been caught. There's other things in his record that are this thick. They offered me attempted murder in the first degree. I wouldn't have had to go to court. But he would have only done 7 years like he did before, and he'd be out and he'd do it again. And this, the next time, I'm sure he wouldn't let them go because I told. He let me go and I told. Frank Calistero, the psychologist, likened him to Ted Bundy or Ward Weaver and said that he, in his mind, he had elevated to murder. We deadlocked on the attempted murder during the trial because his priors were not known or not allowed to be brought up. The list is so long on the things that he was convicted of that I cannot state them all. Did not have it before me. But I felt like I did have some sort of justice. I was never vengeful through the whole thing. I would never want to seek harm on him. What I felt like was relieved. If you have a mad dog, you need to put it down or you need to lock it away. And this man is a danger not only to himself but to other people. The judge said that there was nothing that they have now that could help fix him. So she gave him no programs, gave him 25 years, no programs, et cetera. And then he got another extra 100 months for dangerous offender. So I thought this was done. And then I got a letter in the mail. I felt like I was starting to recover and put this behind me. And it's difficult every year to face the date and the seasonal tragedy that comes along with it. And I'll end it with this. Yeah. But I opened a letter one day I got from the state, opened it, and dropped to my knees. I felt like I did the day that I had to go to trial for this. With the weight of every other woman out there, the pressure of feeling like I've got to do something about this. Opened the letter up and then saw that they wanted to give 30% off for earned behavior. And that very much disappoints me. It caused my post-traumatic stress to come back, anxiety, went into counseling, went on an antidepressant that caused me to go manic, and had to recover back off of that. It's been very overwhelming, and for the first time I'm starting, instead of feeling like a survivor, I'm starting to feel like a victim. And so I very strongly oppose. I realize that this measure is trying to bring positive things. I have been through victims assistance and I've had some help. I appreciate these things, but do we sin that grace may abound? There's got to be another way other than allowing these people that reoffend and reoffend and reoffend another chance. When do we get a chance? As survivors, when do we get a chance? What do we earn? And, you know, here we're trying to plead not for ourselves. It's already happened to us. We're everyday people that this isn't supposed to happen to. I am a strong, aggressive woman. I am not supposed to be a victim. And yet here I am. So I didn't beg that night. And the most humiliating thing that I ever had to do was sit before a jury and have to show my feelings to plead for them to put this man away, to save them, everybody being them. Because I'd already survived. I wasn't afraid for me anymore. I never begged. But to let him sit there and to humiliate myself and do that and have Worley sit there enjoying feasting on every moment of my suffering, wanting to know if he demeaned me and destroyed me and ruined me. So this is the first time I've sat, and I would say I beg of you to please oppose this bill.
All right, thank you. I'm going to conclude our hearing today, and what I'm going to do is allow you to come back on Thursday if you want to conclude the people who signed up to testify today. With that, thank you very much for coming forward and giving us your perspective. For both of you, I know it's very difficult for you to do, just as the others, but I thank you for coming forward today. We'll conclude the comments.